Hi, everybody. Looks like we're showing Avatar or something. Fill every seat here. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Bill Clark. Hi, everybody. I have the honor and the pleasure of being a longtime friend of Alcoholics Anonymous and currently, I rotated in April. Off of my term as a Class A trustee with the General Service Board. Thank you. It's been a wonderful growth experience for me. I may have a chance to share something about that as we go along, and maybe not. All depends. You're all so kind to help everybody find seats, and thanks very much. I'd like to start, as I'm sure you've been starting in other sessions, with a moment of silence to show our gratitude for the AA recoveries over the past 75 years. It's my great pleasure to have three wonderful speakers with us today. I'm just going to make one or two comments and then ask Diane to kick off, and I'll introduce her at that moment. I just want to share with you a little of my experience, very briefly. Like, I remember my first AA meeting. I'll bet some of you do, too. It was in a church basement in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was an internal medicine resident at the Boston City Hospital. All my patients were dying of alcoholism. And somebody thought maybe I should know a little more about alcoholism, so they declared that I would go to an AA meeting. It took me a little while to get organized. I put on my white coat so people would be sure to know that, you know, I wasn't one of them. I can't say that meeting changed my life, but the meetings I've been to since and many of my personal experiences as a subspecialist in addiction medicine and in internal medicine in general, along with a couple of family members, I've been married twice, and both my mothers-in-law had alcoholism, both sobered up in Alcoholics Anonymous and remained sober until they died not too long ago. I'm not sure what having two mothers-in-law with alcoholism means, but it's probably not too important. So that's been part of my growth in understanding something about the way to get well using the AA principles. So, enough from me. You're here to hear the speakers. First, let me just identify Dr. Diane Westerhoff first, Dr. Joe Robotin, and Dr. Richard Sander to the far left. And Dr. Westerhoff is going first. She's a graduate of the University of Toronto Medical School. She has a master's in health science with a subspecialty in bioethics. She's currently working as a family doc in the First Nations Health, Calgary, Alberta, and as a physician assessor with Alberta Medical Association Physician and Family Support Program. She does precepting for University of Calgary medical students and family practice residents. Please help me welcome Dr. Westerhoff.
Thank you very much, Bill. Can you hear me at the back? So I am Diane Westerhoff. I'm a grateful friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a privilege to be here and be in a room with so much goodwill and wisdom from recovering and recovered alcoholics. Well, as you know, in Canada, we have an enviable health service, but every now and then things happen. So now two Canadian alcoholics met up in heaven, and they were in the cafeteria lineup when a man rushed past them rather rudely, getting to the front of the line. So one alcoholic asked the other alcoholic, "Who does he think he is?" "Oh, that's God. He's pretending he's a doctor." So clearly, doctors are important. I would, like it said, though, when I use the term doctor, I would like to refer generically to all the healthcare professionals that work in this very challenging field. We do save lives, and so does AA. And there have been quite a number of notable doctors in AA history, and this is more for my education than yours. Dr. Bob Smith, Dr. Silkworth, Dr. B. Rush, who in 1784 defined alcoholism as a disease. That's 1784. Dr. Carl Jung and Dr. Jelinek, to name a few. But I hope to name a few more. So my plan is to tell you of my own personal medical experience with AA, the experience of the Faculty of Medicine at University of Calgary, and how you might help your family doctor reach out to suffering alcoholics. So I've been a family doctor for 36 years, and I've worked in a lot of emergency departments and clinical settings, rural, urban, reservations. And in my opinion, alcoholism wins the award for the most drama in medicine and surgery. Unfortunately, the award for carnage as well. There are hemorrhages, seizures, delirium, trauma, violence. These are only a few of the scenarios, and unfortunately, many of you may be known to you. So alcoholism-related diseases is a major healthcare concern, and a 2008 American Hospital Survey, it accounted for between 25 and 40% of all general hospital admissions. The cost per year was over $115 billion. So despite our best efforts, something's not working, and the patient is still drinking. So in the big book, it says, talks about the four horsemen for alcoholics: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Well, guess what? Doctors feel the same. And despite our science and best practices, the disease continues. So what to do? Well, Yogi Berra says, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. So I decided to try something new. About 6 years ago, I actually did what I recommend to my patients, and that is I went to an AA meeting. I was astounded by a room full of honesty, loving kindness, strength, hope, encouragement, wisdom, dedication, goodwill. I was overwhelmed. And I've still going to meetings, including Al-Anon, and I feel personally transformed, and this experience has very much informed my clinical and teaching practices. I realize that while science preserves life, AA and the 12x12 steps and tradition gives alcoholics a tool to process life. Now, trust me, as I'm a doctor, carried no weight with Dr. Silkworth. And his experience with alcoholic patients led him to understand that what the alcoholic needs is depth, ruthless honesty and accurate identification of the problem, and weight as a solution, a recovery through a spiritual awakening. He understood that the alcoholic was only safe if he trusted his own notion in a higher power, a power greater than himself. Depth and weight. A life informed by a higher power, and a life lived by those principles. Clearly, AA is for adults. This is called spiritual maturity. So while AA makes medical science, in my view, take another look, AA does something that science does not. In Carl Jung's letter to Bill Wilson in 1961, he stated, alcohol in Latin is spiritus. And if you use the same word for the highest religious experience. The helpful formula, therefore, is spiritus contra spiritum, drinking against your spirit. Well, clearly you can have your spiritum and drink it too. So Jung stated that craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst expressed in medieval language for the union with God. So alcoholism makes you choose spiritual life or die. So all in all, we're all in this together. Both science and spirituality explore what is not known. Doctors use this knowledge to heal the body, unus corporalis, and AA uses it to heal the spirit, unus spiritualis. So vision is where you want to end up, and that's the theme of this wonderful celebration. Where there is no vision, people perish, Proverbs 29:18. Our vision is that science can work with spirituality in the service for others. Again, Dr. Silkworth recognized this. In his opinion, the key principle which makes AA work, where other plans have proved inadequate, is that it proposes a way of life based on the belief of the individual in a power greater than himself. In my experience, spiritual wellness is the keystone of all wellness, physical, emotional, and social. So how are we doing in Calgary, putting this into practice? Well, Dr. Phil Stokes at the University Hospital has initiated a 3-hour compulsory program for clinical clerks during their psychiatry rotation. Dr. Todd Hill, PhD in the Department of Family Practice, is also starting a block program over 50 hours for alcoholism and addiction treatment. It's similar to the program initiated by Dr. Rabinovich and Dr. Pace in New York. They call it PAT, Physician Alcoholism and Addiction Training Program. All I can say is that there have been so much enthusiastic replies to our inquiries about starting new initiatives for family practice residents. Calgary also has hosted, for over the last 3 years, alcohol addiction education and networking conferences. On each occasion, our keynote speaker is a recovered alcoholic. I have permission to use their names. Bowery to the Boardroom, Frank O'Day, founder of Second Cup. My Story in Self-Care for the Alcoholic, Jeffrey Poole, also a founder of Second Cup. And Theron Fleury, NHL player for the Calgary Flames, and I think he went to Chicago. To summarize, when healthcare professionals reached out, the hand of AA was there. In these conferences, the cooperation for professional development was there. Cooperation for professional committee was always there with AA literature. So how might you help your family doctor? First, it's really important to tell him how AA saved your life. We really need to know about the successes. Invite him to a meeting, or better still, bring a meeting to his office or an education event. That's what happens with the clinical clerks. There's about 30 AA volunteers who stage a mock meeting, and then after the meeting, in groups of four, they have one-on-one discussion with the medical students. Invite him to any CPC event. Bring him AA literature. Buddy with a medical student, and volunteer someplace where there are drunks, such as emergency departments. So, in closing, James 2:26 says, "For just as a body without a spirit is dead, so also faith without works is dead." The healthcare professionals and AA share a common vision. The vision of AA: to be helpful is our only aim, to stay sober and help other alcoholics. But our missions or our means are very different. In the handout, if you are a professional, there's a list of all the things that AA does not do. I'll give you a general idea. Furnish initial motivation for alcoholics to recover, solicit members, engage in or sponsor research, keep attendance records or case histories, and so on. It's in the handout here if you can remember it. But the beauty of this list of all the things that AA does not do, interestingly, is all the things that healthcare professionals do. So thank goodness for the difference. We are both responsible for our own best part, separate but together, in mutual respect, and grounded in a knowledge of a higher power. All said, Dr. Bob stated in his last address to AA members, don't louse it up. With Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have little to do with actual AA work. I'm grateful for all the alcoholics in my life. They've been my best teachers. I'm grateful for the wisdom and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and for the opportunity to share with you this incredible 75-year celebration. And I'm grateful for your kind attention. I look forward to meeting you as we trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you so much, Diane. I'm really pleased to be able to be up here with you and the others. I just wanted to make another comment about some of my time with AAers and with the General Service Board. Medical school didn't teach me much about humility. In fact, it was kind of the other way around. So my time with you all has been one of wonderful spiritual growth. You know, things like discernment and gratitude and courage, graciousness, generosity, they weren't things that were talked about much in school and even in my postgraduate training. But, of course, it's the stuff of spiritual recovery. And although it took me a while, I think I'm still on the path, I think I have learned that finally it's not about me, it's about us. You know, we're all in this together, as some of us are on the professional side, as Diane emphasized, and some of us are a little bit more on the spiritual side, and we're glad to be working together. Next, we have Dr. Jill Robotin, who went to the University of Minnesota Medical School and then spent 20 years in New York City. I thought I was at a big, bad hospital, lots of alcoholics, but his time was at Bellevue in New York. So I see people know something about Bellevue. He's now a professor of medicine at Brown Medical School, working regularly with students and residents in Providence, Rhode Island, and he's going to share a little bit about his experience, strength, and hope with us. Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Bill. I'm going to make 3 points with you this afternoon, and the first one is that medical students need Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to tell you a little bit about my experience with this organization, and then I'm going to put you to work. I'm going to ask you to help me improve what doctors are taught about how to talk to people about alcohol. So let's just start with that. I'd like you to turn to your neighbor and talk a little bit about what you think medical students need to learn about talking to people about alcohol.
I couldn't
couldn't be the best.
Oh, of course. Somebody taught you well.
I know this can go on because this is what I need from you, and this is what all the medical students around the world need from you, is how to learn how to talk to people about alcohol. So thank you for what you've just done, and save those ideas and keep those ideas in your heads and give them to me before Sunday. Or after Sunday. I met Bill Clark 20 years ago as part of a group of doctors who are interested in how to teach doctors how to communicate better. So, as you know, doctors are not so good at communicating, although we've been working for 20 years to keep doctors from interrupting patients in the first 18 seconds, which is what happens. I was privileged enough to have special training at Hazelden in Florida and at NYU, and helped learn how to help doctors learn more about alcohol. Let me tell you why I think medical students need this organization. Each year I give the one-hour lecture that all Brown medical students get on alcohol. 1 hour out of 4 years. And I don't mean to minimize it, but I want you to just think about it from my perspective, because what would you say to 100 very smart, very kind of motivated first-year medical students? Boy, have they worked hard, right? And they're listening. Their pens are ready. Okay, 1 hour. So what I do is, what I did was get Bill Clark to help me prepare, and did my best. But this is what happens after they hear what I have to say. When I ask, what did you learn today? Here are some quotes from April 1st, 2008. I don't know. Do or can patients change their drinking before hitting a crisis? And this word patient already, right? You're not a person, you're a patient, right? Do patients ever go totally sober without first hitting bottom? Gosh, I wonder if that question has ever been talked about among any of you. I'm a little confused about what interventions have been shown to work for problem drinkers. A light touch talk like today's demo, or more aggressive kind of interventions. Also, what is a problem drinker? Someone drinking more than is under the healthy limits, or someone currently experiencing real negative consequences? And how bad must those consequences be? A headache or a divorce? Still confused. What did you learn today, Tuesday, April 1st, 2008, after Dr. Robotin's lecture? I learned that the incidence of alcohol abuse is low in the United States. And other countries? Question mark, question mark. I learned to try to get the patient to bring up the subject. What would make this session better? A more realistic interview. Have patients who are resistant to counseling. Have patients who do not want to change. These are really smart, really interested medical students who've just heard the best I could do to help them learn about alcohol. What did you learn today? The spectrum of alcohol use, how to talk to people about alcohol, and that doctors are important factors in alcohol. I want you to just hear those because those were kind of some of the nicer ones. It's not all that easy. I've got a lot of negative comments, and that doesn't feel good to me either. Like, I felt really voyeuristic and intrusive at the AA meeting because all of the medical students at Brown are required to attend an open AA meeting. I don't think we should go to AA meetings. And I didn't really learn much. So my point is, and my hope is, that you will be engaged and will help us teach the medical students. And I promised the faculty at Brown Medical School to bring back ideas, so I really need your help. I'm going to leave it at that. I'm going to tell you that I think a lot of doctors know about AA, but I don't think not enough doctors know enough about AA. And it would be my hope that all doctors are able to attend an open meeting and can speak clearly to their patients about AA. And thank you for letting me be here today. I can't wait for tonight, and thank you so much for coming and helping.
Thank you so much, Joe. I expect that we may have a little time for people to give you those responses, too. I wanted to say one more thing about my experience, particularly with the General Service Conference and the General Service Board in New York City. We meet in New York City. Of course, they come from all around the country and Canada to those meetings. I just am hopeful because I see with what passion, vigor, and clarity the people in the General Service Office serve the fellowship and to help you and sometimes the rest of us, give away what you've got. And they do it with grace and generosity. AA love is the best kind of love, and I get to see it. I have gotten to see an awful lot of it over the past few years. And so I continue to be, despite Joe's difficulties with those students, which I also have experienced, I continue to be hopeful about the possibility of doing a better job in medical education and medical schools. And I hope we can enlist you all in some of the ways that Joe has mentioned, and we may hear more ideas as the afternoon goes on. I'd like to move on to Dr. Richard Sander, on my far left, who's a graduate of Yale College and the University of Southern California Medical School. He worked as an emergency room physician where he saw his share of alcohol problems for a few years before he went into the psychiatry program at UCLA and has been working in the field of addictions since 1980. He's a past president of the California Society of Addiction Medicine, and he's recently published a book called Thinking Simply About Addiction. And I'm really very pleased that he's able to be here to share some of his thoughts with you all. Please help me welcome him.
Wow. I feel like I should be a lot more nervous than I am. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think what I want to do today is to tell all of you that you have a great deal to teach those of us in the healthcare professions. And I want to get that across by telling you some of the experiences I've had working in the field. Not so much by way of technique of telling you what to do. I don't think you need that. But just to tell you that what you bring to us works. Maybe that's called inspiration, something like that. The lessons I've had, however, have taken time. So you need to be patient with us. We're, as you heard, trained, you know, to be experts. I'll have a little story at the end about that if there's time. And it's it takes time for us to get the idea that somebody else, mainly the person who's got the problem, might actually know what to do about it. In the spirit of rigorous honesty, I want to share something with you, which I've actually been waiting for a long time to say this. I give a kind of a shortened version of it in the book, so now's a chance to come fully forward with what actually happened. I derailed off a kind of a promising career in medical research and wound up as an emergency room doctor in Gardena, California, which is right next to South Central LA, kind of a war zone. I knew that wasn't going to last. I got interested again in the mind and the body interaction. We called it psychosomatic medicine, then went back to psychiatry training at UCLA. But I had continued to moonlight in the emergency room. So when I finished my psych residency, I didn't quite know what to do yet, strangely enough. And I went back to the emergency room full time. July, August, September, drifted into October, November. And then one day in November, a guy came from down upstairs in the hospital, the fourth floor, and he said, "Rich, how would you like to take over the care unit? I'm going to be moving to Seattle, and you'd be perfect for this. You've got the great psychiatric training, and you've got the medicine background, the emergency room. It'd be great for you." And I said, "What's a care unit?" Some people remember. And he said, "Oh, you work with alcoholics and addicts." And I said, "On purpose?" I was polite. "No, thank you." The very next day, as God is my witness, the very next day, my now bosses, my former partners, but now my bosses in the emergency room, came to me with the bad news that we were losing the contract to provide the emergency medicine services for the hospital come January. So if I was going to get that psychiatric practice started, I'd better get busy and get going. Well, I had, you know, a mortgage and two kids, and so I thought about it seriously, you know, for about 30 seconds. And I went back upstairs to the hospital and pronounced my newfound interest in working with alcoholics and addicts. So when people say, "How'd you get into the field?" I say, "Kicking and screaming." Then to make things even stranger, the man who had hired me, the clinical director of the program, quit after 2 weeks of being there. And they hired a man whose name I can use because he's now dead, may he rest in peace, Tom Redgate. Some of you may know his name. Who was an old-time recovering alcoholic who listed his educational background for the job. Jackson State, which is the penitentiary in Michigan. He was a bearded, gruff, burly Bostonian, and he got on the unit, he looked things out, he sized me up for, you know, a little while, and he said, "Even though you're a doctor, I think you might be educable. Would you like to learn about alcoholism?" And I said, "Sure." And he said, "Would you come to meetings with me?" And I said, "Sure, I have nothing to lose." And he hauled me off to these meetings. And it just stuck immediately. I never laughed so hard in my life. I never wept openly, except, you know, when my mother said things to me. And I found out, I learned about recovery, which is something in all my fine academic education, I had never learned anything about. I knew how to detox people. I knew how to treat all kinds of physical and psychiatric illnesses. I knew nothing about recovery. And these wonderful people in the meetings taught me about how recovery comes as a result of working the steps. So that's the first lesson I've had in rigorous honesty. The second lesson came pretty quick, had to do with courage. I had a patient in this unit who I discharged. He was a great big guy. He was, shall I say, from the other side of the tracks. He finished the program, and I gave him a little piece of paper, a discharge paper, to go back to work, and had his diagnosis, alcoholism, on it, and off he went. And about 10 minutes, David came back up the elevator, and he got this piece of paper, and he says, "Doc, you've got to change this." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "It says alcoholism. I'm not going back to work with that on there." He says, you change it to something." I said, "Well, I can't change medical records." He says, "Yeah, you can. You're a doctor. You can do anything." I said, "No, man, these are medical records. It's against the law to alter medical records. I'm not going to do that." And we started to go at it. And one of the things he said, which I remember very well, "Blah, blah, blah, I'll have you taken care of in the street." And I don't know where this came from. And I looked at him and I said, "Okay, so I'm supposed to take my medical license, my 11 or 12 years of postgraduate education, tear it to shreds and throw it in the waste basket for your vanity. Is that the idea?" Off he started. I was very careful when I went to my car for the next couple of weeks out of the hospital. Okay, cut to 5 years later. I'm now the medical director of a treatment program in Marina Del Rey, up the street a ways. And I walk onto the unit my very first day, and there's this great big guy standing by the nurse's station. And he strides right up to me, and he says, "Hi, Doc, David." And by then I've had 4,500 different patients, And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't remember you." And he says, "Oh, you will. You were going to tear your license into little shreds." And then I said, "Oh, David, I'm so sorry to see that you're back in the hospital." He says, no, man, I'm one of the counselors." And a fine one, too, a really fine one. I've learned something about faith. At this same program in Marina Del Rey, they had a 20-bed unit. We had a nice little sunbathing area in the middle of the thing where green grass was, and not very big. This was not a fancy program, but it had a little area to sunbathe. Anyway, we also had a patient in there at one time named I'll use a pseudonym, Lauren. Lauren was 23 years old. She had snorted so much cocaine that she'd put a hole through the septum of her nose, and she was stunningly gorgeous, Playboy centerfold material. At the time she was in the program, we had 19 men in the program and Lauren. And Lauren liked to go out on this little grassy area and lie down on her stomach and undo the back of her little bikini and sunbathe. And the guys would all be standing at the windows, panting. And so the nurses, of course, said, "Dr. Sandor, you have to do something about this." And so Lauren and I started doing battle about her bikini and whether or not she was going to wear a bra while she went up and down the unit and so on and so forth. And we battled up, and everybody wanted to discharge her, but, she hadn't broken any of the rules, and so we kept her. We also had amazing arguments about the higher power idea and so on and so forth. Cut to 5 years later. See, these lessons take time. I'm on a five-year plan. I've taken over a program at the Sepulveda VA. I have just come back from a video conference of all the VA treatment programs across the country, in which I have learned that treatment doesn't really seem to alter long-term outcome. Okay, so all this money and time and effort we're pouring into treatment doesn't really seem to pan out too much after 10 years. So, in other words, I've just thrown the last 10 years of my medical work out the window. I sort of slumped, as I sat down at my desk, and the phone rang. Bring. I picked it up. "Hello, this is Dr. Sandor." And the voice on the other end says, "Hello, this is Lauren." And again, "I'm sorry, I don't remember." She says, "Oh, yeah, you'll remember. Bikini." And I remembered. And she said, "I just wanted to call to tell you that I'm now 5 years sober. I'm the secretary of my meeting here in the San Fernando Valley. And I just graduated from college, and I was number 12 in my class. And I want to thank you for all the arguing about the higher power." So it took some faith to continue that in the face of not knowing whether or not we were doing any good. I still hold on to that memory fondly. I've also learned something about theft, that is, in stealing from you help out with our programs. One of the things I learned, we set up a nonprofit hospital for indigent alcoholics in Long Beach back in 1982 called Tom Redgate Memorial Hospital. Still there and functioning well. And one of the things we decided to do based on the model of sponsorship was that when people finished their rehab stay at the end of about 28, 30 days, part of their rehab work was to come back to the detox and help out with the very newest people. And I acknowledge that was complete theft from AA. Thank you very much. It had a great impact on people. When I took over the VA program at Sepulveda, it was kind of a revolving door methadone maintenance detox. It was a god-awful mess. The people were just coming in to lower their habits and not really to get clean and sober. So I knew, however, that recovery is work. I can't make anybody recover. I can't do something to somebody to make them stop drinking or using. I can set up the conditions in which they can do the work if they want to, but I can't make anybody do it. And so rather than waste a lot of time on people who weren't going to do the work, when people would call up to be admitted to the program, we had two conditions. One was you had to come to two pre-admission groups. You didn't have to be clean. You didn't have to be sober. You just had to show up at the meeting. I mean, that's all. And you had to pay $1. That went into a kitty for the guys who were already on the unit. That deterred about 75% of the people who were calling. But the ones who were left, you know, we had a little indication that they were going to be willing to work at recovery. So it was worthwhile to make the time and investment with them. So I credit all of you with all that. I've also not been very successful, I'm afraid, with my colleagues in the university setting, and so I've had to learn a little bit of acceptance. In about 1986 or 87, I was invited to propose a drug and alcohol treatment program for a university in Southern California, which I will not name. And I did, and it was very well received, and we were well on the way to setting the thing up, and by God, my dream of becoming a professor was going to come true. And I was so thrilled. Only one thing remained, and that was to talk to the chairman of the psychiatry department about it. Now, he was known to me. I was known to I won't say friends, but he certainly knew who I was and had respect for what I'd been doing, so I wasn't too nervous about it, and he was very excited with the proposal. It looked like we were going to go. And then I said, now, I'll use a pseudonym for him, Jerry, you know, there's just one thing that we've got to get clear right now, and that is there's going to have to be a very strong AA presence on the unit. Do any of you know the phrase sea change? Well, it happened in Jerry's face. One moment he was looking at me, nodding and like that, and then suddenly there was a change. And you could see that something had gone on inside. The substance was different. The form, the outer form was sort of the same, but something invisible inside had changed. And he leaned back, master politician, he leaned back and he looked up and he said, well, Rich, you know, that's fine. That'll be fine. As long as they remember that we're the experts. And I saw my professorship crash and burn. And sadly to say, we did not get the program established there. There is one now, but it doesn't have the AA presence that it needs. I think somebody asked me earlier, what's the relationship between professional treatment and the 12-step programs, which, of course, are not professional. And I conceive of treatment as helping people overcome obstacles to becoming dedicated, active members of AA. I figure that, here's how I figure it. Lots and lots of people, thousands of people have gotten sober, clean and sober, without ever talking to a professional at all about going to a meeting. So they just figure it out, or they have an awakening, they have a moment of clarity, they hit bottom, they go to meetings, they work the steps, they recover. So if somebody's come to see me as a professional, something must be in the way of them having done that, right? So then it's my job to sort of figure out what are the obstacles And how can I help the person get over the obstacles? I don't substitute myself for AA, but I recognize that people identify me as somebody who can help, and they, therefore they must have obstacles to doing the thing that I know will help, which is if they become a member of AA and work the steps. Those obstacles can take many forms. They can take the form of psychiatric illness. They can take the form of physical illness. They can take the form of family problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it takes a lot of diagnostic skill and cleverness to help people overcome those kinds of obstacles. And maybe there'll be questions about this as we go on. Finally, this is a real quick story. I've had some terrific lessons in humility. And one of my favorite, I forgot to bring it with me, but it's a little telephone memo sheet. You've seen those books, you know, that have a spiral-bound thing where you write a memo and tear it off, and there's a carbon copy of it underneath. Well, this happened at Redgate back in, I think, about 1983 or so. I had written an article for a local newspaper called the Long Beach Press Telegram, and I got a note from the secretary of the program who was a very devoted and well-meaning person. Judy was not, however, what you call the sharpest knife in the drawer, the brightest bulb on the tree. And so she got this telephone call, and she had written me a little note. The note said, "To Dr. Sandor from Dennis H. Messages. Says the article you wrote changed his life. Parentheses. I guess for the better." There's a wonderful quotation I'll close with, which comes from a poet whose name I cannot pronounce. I think it's Marian Ruckheiser. Is that right? Muriel, thank you, Ruckheiser, who said this wonderful quote, "The universe is not made of atoms, but of stories." And I just wanted to say thank you for the stories.
Thank you very much, Richard. And thank you all for helping our speakers. We do have some time, and I'd be happy to entertain questions and move them along. Hands went right up. I'll acknowledge you first and then go around a bit. I'll repeat the questions so the group can hear. The practice in Australia is harm minimization, and our questioner thinks it may be doing more harm than good and wonders what the panelists think. And I wonder if anybody would like to comment. Rich, you moved your chair back. That was a nonverbal. It was powerful. Yeah.
You got me going. You can't shut me up. I don't know exactly what harm minimization is. Oh, my gosh.
It was a trick question.
A trick question. You know, it bears on the larger issue that I think I want to reiterate, that is that you have a great deal to teach the professionals. Yeah, exactly. You are the experts. Doctors, generally people trained in the healthcare professions, don't understand why abstinence is necessary for recovery, which means that they're paying lip service to the disease concept of addiction, of alcoholism. And I think that's part of the problem, and it's true. I mean, that attempts to teach people to control their drinking, if they're true alcoholics, just has never worked. It never will. But there's good scientific foundation for why, and I guess in Australia they have to catch up to that. I don't have any other opinion than that.
Anybody else want to comment?
I think the speaker said that she's trying to help people understand that if people are still drinking, it's still harming. And it's really not minimizing anything, and that what people need to do is not minimize, but stop. Did I capture the sense of what you said? Yeah.
I just had a comment that when I said that alcoholism is wins the award for the biggest medical and surgical drama, it engages and enmeshes many healthcare professionals, and we become rescuers. And that's another word for enabling. And this program has taught me the beauty of this program is ruthless honesty. If you can drink and doesn't, you know, and you're not an alcoholic, then, you know, sayonara. But, you know, strut your stuff.
Let's see. I think this lady over here. Let me tell people what you've started with, Shirley, and then you can tell us the three things. Shirley's a member of another 12-step program. She's worried about the suffering of families who also recover or die, and has a couple of comments to add to that. Thank you, Shirley, who reminds us that as professionals, health professionals, we need to remember that living with an alcoholic is a very harmful thing as well, and that we should bear that in mind when we're talking with family members. The lady in the back in the yellow, the way back, please make yourself heard if you can. Thank you very much. And we would love to be mindful that we do need to reach out to families, and that listening to family members would be extremely helpful for medical students to hear. I don't know if Joe's program or Diane's or Richard's brings in family members to help educate. Not yet. So that's a terrific suggestion. Thank you very much. Let's see now. There was somebody over here on the edge in the gray shirt. Yeah. Healthcare professionals need to take advantage of the moment when the person is at the bottom in a hospital bed and be active at that time. Let me just ask if one of the other panelists wants to comment about that or not. Yeah, Joe would like to speak to that.
Thank you. And that's a really common experience and a really difficult experience for medical students and residents because they don't know what to do. And, you know, this idea of humility and how the doctors are really at a loss at that bottom moment. It's hard for them to even come close to the idea of a window of opportunity to help someone in the long run because it's really hard for them to, you know, connect to someone at that moment. So it's a special circumstance, and thank you for reminding us about it.
So we'll move to the other side. Let's see the lady with the hand wiggling over there. No, the blue one, yeah. It was pretty discouraging to face people coming back in again as a hospitalist. Go ahead. What a great question from a health professional. If somebody doesn't quite seem ready to quit and they're in my hospital bed, what can I do then to seize the opportunity? And I expect our panelists will have something to say about that. Oh, call AA. That was good. Let me ask for comments from the panelists. I know Diane already talked about ruthless honesty. Perhaps you want to put that into language that might be helpful to a student or resident, or someone else does.
Well, I think it's a great question, and it just speaks very much to the soul of what I was saying, is that we have a common vision. I'm going to do my part, but hello, look at you, 50,000 strong, do your part, 12, step it.
Be ruthless, be honest. Let's see, the fellow in the dark shirt here. 12 Steps Illustrated, the pictures, you know, cartoons. It's really good for doctors, yeah. A couple suggestions for students. One is to use that 60-cent pamphlet with the pictures in it, which, you know, doctors learn a lot from words, and so they're very smart with words. And I think it's a terrific bit of intuition to notice that a few pictures can go maybe worth 1,000 words. And the other suggestion was give students a copy of the big book. I want to comment about that. When I first read the big book, I thought it was nonsense. You know, it didn't make any sense to me as a doctor. I had to come face to face with people who knew what was in the big book and hear that because of the big book, they were alive and well and leading a life that had humor and spirit and excitement in it. Then I began to understand that what was in the big book was something I really should know about, but it took a while. Anybody else want to comment at this level of teaching tools? No. Let me take another one. Oh, there's so many hands. Let's try this lady here. Hi.
I'm also a nurse practitioner in family medicine.
Uh-huh. Thanks for coming. Yeah. Thanks, Rebecca. Let me just repeat a little of what you said. Rebecca's in recovery. She's a nurse practitioner. She does really well with the alcoholic and addict patients, and all of her colleagues are coming to her and saying, well, gee, you know, how do you do it, and what can I do, and what's the evidence basis for what you do? And as she says, I don't want to break my anonymity. What can I tell my colleagues? And I'm going to ask my colleagues to help with that. Rich?
I think one of the most wonderful resources available is a book called The Natural History of Alcoholism by George Valiant. And it's a difficult book. It's it takes study. It takes some work, but it's very well worth going on. They followed two groups of patients, 400 young men who they picked up as junior high school students in Boston in 1940, and they have followed them forward until the present. About a quarter of them became alcoholic, and of those, a whole bunch of them have now gone into recovery. And what's really clear from the study, I mean, it takes a while to get through it, but you need evidence. You know, it's evidence. It's very good scientific evidence. That, in summary, that if people will become dedicated active members of AA, they almost always recover. What's the big book been saying for years? You know, I mean, you know, rarely have we seen someone, et cetera, right? So, I mean, it's a difficult book, I will warn you, but it's well worth your time and study. Every course I've ever taught on it, I've used it, and it's a superb resource. Yeah, it's by George Valiant. Spells it in an odd way. He pronounces it Valiant, but it's V-A-I-L-L-A-N-T. And it's called The Natural History of Alcoholism. I don't want to promote my book, but in chapters 2 and 3, no, really. But I made a digest of a lot of the findings in there that might be easier to follow. But you ought to go to the main one.
It's called The Natural History of Alcohol. Oh, his book. Rich, they need the name of your book. Thinking Simply About Addictions. I want to make one more comment. The evidence base is strong. If people really want the evidence, they have to dig for it. You know, reading, learning from science and scientific papers and stuff is not something you toss off in a pamphlet or a few cartoons, although a pamphlet or a few cartoons can explain it. It isn't the evidence itself. And so I just wholeheartedly agree that if people want evidence, we got the evidence. Tell them where it is and they can go find it if they want, or they can keep listening to you and do what you do. I also want to mention that Dr. Valiant has another book which I want to recommend to this particular group. It's called Spiritual Evolution. And George has written about the connections between what we're like as people, spiritual beings, and how our brains work. You've heard some other discussion in other sessions, at least I have today, about the new understandings of connections between our spirituality and the way our brains work. So it's not just about the connections between what we know and how our brains work, but it's sort of how we live and how our brains work. George's book helped me a lot understand that it's not all about me, that it's about community, it's about working together, it's about compassion, joy, awe, forgiveness, gratitude, all those things that you all understand if you're working the program. But it's very helpful for professionals to read that there's a scientific basis for the spiritual program of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's called Spiritual Evolution. George Valiant. Man in the blue shirt in the back.
Speaking of evidence-based rigorous honesty.
Rigorous honesty. What's the reality about success rates from treatment? I'm going to invite my other panelists to help me with this one. Anybody want to comment? Joe.
Thanks for the question. I'm going to also mention one other resource, which is Project TREAT for the person who asked. It's a really nice study done at the University of Wisconsin by Michael Fleming, and it's very attractive to medical students and other health professionals because it's very evidence-based and it's a well-controlled, double-blinded study, which, you know, they're going to like. So success rates, I pretty much avoid the topic with medical students at Brown. I teach about smoking cessation as well, and, you know, the success rates for that are also very kind of lowish, double-digit, you know, teens. And so I think the truth is it's kind of counterproductive to talk about success rates because I think you've made the point nicely, both of you, that these are lifelong things. And that's my message. I mean, I think the message that if we can get medical students to know or all health profession students to know that this important work that you all know well about takes many years. I think 20-year-old students don't really naturally know that, you know? And I think that some do, but if you want to change anything about yourself, it will take years. So to me, that's more of an important message than a success rate.
Thanks. I do want to leave time for people to talk to the panelists at the front here. We've got about 15 minutes left. I'm going to take a couple more questions and then close down. And, gee, you know, it's just so hard to know where to go, but let's go to the front row. Alex is an alcoholic. Hi, Alex. Works as an EMT. Alex is pointing out that ruthless honesty from someone who's been through it is a lot more effective than evidence from your doctor. And we hope that we can invite and get some of you folks to help us talk with patients from time to time. I know many of you already do. Let's see, we'll take one more. How about the lady in the striped shirt there? Thank you. I said I was going to end with two, so. Okay. Rigorous honesty instead of ruthless. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience. Please help me thank the speakers one more time, and then we'll close. Thank you all.